This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 26th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary, headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest, the Big Deal feature, journalist and author Terry Glavin on why Canadians should pause and commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or do the House leaders of British Columbia's three legislature parties owe British Columbians an explanation about why they let disgraced clerk Craig James off the hook? If you remember last November when James was suspended with pay, he claimed that he did no wrong and he demanded his job back. Fast forward to the report by retired Supreme Court Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin. She found that James had committed misconduct in four cases. One of those was when James created a $257,000 payment to himself in 2012. He called it a pension allowance. McLaughlin's report went to the three House leaders, and the writing was on the wall for James. Instead of facing the music for his corruption and waste, however, James chose the easy way out. He retired. His lawyers negotiated an exit that we have been told includes a non-monetary clause, which means, in a nutshell, that no more money is to be paid to James, but James will not have to repay the taxpayers for his misconduct. Why? That $257,000 could help some people. It'd pay the wages for a couple of cops to investigate money laundering for a year. It could put three or four teachers in schools or nurses in hospitals to work for a year. It could house maybe half a dozen homeless teens or women for a year. Under this settlement, it appears that that money that James pocketed is lost forever. But that's not a reason for us to not keep asking questions of the House leaders who agreed to this deal. Even more than the money that he took, James harmed the reputation of the legislature at a time when trust in government and trust in democracy was already in steep decline here in British Columbia. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Rim. In the Manila Bulletin, Roy Mabasa and Jenilyn Kabiling report, Canada to remove garbage in June. The decision to ship back the waste to its shores was made after Minister of Environment and Climate Change Catherine McKenna announced that her government awarded a contract to Bolloré Logistics Canada to safely bring the waste back to Canada as soon as possible. Last week, Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs Chrystia Freeland spoke with Foreign Affairs Minister Teodoro Luxon Jr., to reiterate that Canada's firm commitment to promptly repatriate the waste to Canada. The conversation between the two officials came shortly after Canada missed the May 15th deadline set by President Rodrigo Duterte for Ottawa to ship back the tons of garbage it illegally exported by tranches from 2013 to 2014. In 2016, a Philippine court ordered the importers to ship the containers back to Canada at their expense. The local importer, however, did not comply with the court order and has since ceased to operate. Metro Vancouver will be receiving the garbage and incinerating it sometime in June. In ABC News Australia, Paige Coburn and Belinda Contominas report, Election 2019, how the polls got it so wrong in predicting a Labour victory. It was predicted to be the federal election Labour simply could not lose, but after the surprise coalition win, the opinion poll may struggle to stand the test of time. Experts say cost-cutting and technological change in the polling process is leading to many inaccurate and misleading suggestions. Nearly all polls predicted Bill Shorten would have an easy win with a 51-49 lead over Prime Minister Scott Morrison on a two-party preferred basis. In fact, for 2 years, the polls had picked the opposition to take government. One man who did predict a Scott Morrison stay said traditional polling was past its used-by date. Data mining expert from Griffith University, Professor Bella Stantich, who predicted Donald Trump's election to U.S. presidency and Brexit, uses his own methods to gauge opinion. Professor Stantich analyzed 2 million social media comments relating to key terms and predicted labor would not pick up the seats needed. And in the South China Morning Post, Daniel Ren reports, wholesale traders in Yihu rue losses as U.S. tariffs point to a woeful purchasing period ahead of Thanksgiving and Christmas. In previous years, May would be the start of a busy period when buyers from the U.S. and Europe descend on Yihu to place orders for August shipments in time for the Christmas shopping season. Not this year. Located about 150 kilometers from Zhejiang's provincial capital of Hangzhou, Yihu is a window into how China manufactured its way from an agrarian economy into the world's factory and economic powerhouse. Everything and anything conceivable. Cocktail umbrellas, trinkets, Christmas decorations, toys, stationery, machine parts is made in Yihu and sold by the container load. At their peak, Yihu's wholesalers shipped 1,000 containers of products from their market every day, according to the local authority. Within a decade of China's WTO ascension, Yihu became wealthy, boasting at one stage the most number of BMW luxury cars per capita in China. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle PI, Alex Halverson reports, Seattle population increases, but 93 U.S. cities are growing faster, census data says. Seattle was among the top 10 U.S. cities for the highest number of residents added in 2018, with three more Washington cities in the top 100, according to data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Seattle ranked 94th out of 774 cities. The Emerald City's growth was estimated at 2.04% between July 2017 and July 2018. The highest Washington city was Redmond, which had a 4.04% increase. Out of all 774 cities, 23 cities from Washington had positive increases to their population. Federal Way and Burien had lower populations in 2018. Seattle's population grew by more than 15,000 to 744,955, the fourth fastest growing city in the U.S., after the cities of Phoenix, San Antonio, and Fort Worth. In the Haida Gwaii Observer, Natalia Balserjak reports, Nisga Nation tourism industry hits the road. The tour from July 12th to 16th is part of a multi-year plan to encourage and grow tourism into the area with an intention to create more jobs and infrastructure. The five-day tour highlights all four villages of the Nisga Nation with visits to local restaurants, stays at lodges, and cultural activities. Along the way are several stops at scenic nature sites such as the hot springs, the lava beds, waterfalls, and lakes. Approximately eight people, made up of tourism representatives and influencers, will be joining in the tour to test the fluidity of the itinerary and provide feedback on how tourism-ready each location is and how it can be improved. The tour will also be featured on Destination BC, Indigenous Tourism Canada, and through different tour operators. And last week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. After C-SPAN runs flattering ad campaign, Trudeau repays the favor by ordering more ships. Mystery surrounds BC sites where imposter wrote exams. And inside the misconducts of the McLaughlin report, it is hard to understand what was going through Craig James' mind. Read the stories behind the headlines in the Breaker.News. Award-winning journalist and author Terry Glavin joins us from Vancouver Island. Terry is one of Canada's best-known China commentators. You can read Terry Glavin's work in the National Post and Maclean's. June 4th is the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. As many as 10,000 people were killed in the military crackdown on peaceful protesters in Beijing. There were protests throughout China for weeks and months beforehand as people were pushing for more democracy in China, yet China has gone to great lengths to cover up the atrocity for the past three decades. Why should Canadians be observing this anniversary on June 4th?
One reason is that it is certainly, it was one of the most important and significant and gallant uprisings in the cause of democracy for the past half century. You know, when the Berlin Wall fell and when the Soviet Union imploded, a similar thing may, you know, was sort of close to happening in China, but it was apprehended at the point of a gun, and thousands of people were killed. People think of mythology, that we were, you know, really sophisticated and groovy and avant-garde by, you know, being one of the first countries out of the blocks to recognize.
Glavin says that Canada's support for China to enter the United Nations Security Council was a disaster. It has paralyzed the Security Council. So much international revulsion with China over the Tiananmen Square massacre, but Prime Minister Jean Chrétien's Team Canada trade mission in 1994 gave China a new sense of credibility.
We, by we, I mean the federal Canadian taxpayer and the British Columbia taxpayer, we've invested billions and billions and billions of dollars in West Coast infrastructure and other initiatives, just the physical infrastructure, port, rail, highway, all sold to us on the proposition that this would give us opportunities to trade with Asia. And we'd be able to sell our stuff into Asia. The exact opposite has happened. It's been all China all the time. And it's been about China using West Coast ports largely to get stuff into the, you know, huge big box store pods around the American Rust Belt and the American Midwest, using the West Vanport and Delta Port, because it's actually, what is it, 36 hours closer to Shanghai than Los Angeles or something. And our own trade deficit with China has just ballooned. You know, I think it's $75 billion in trade. They sell us $50 billion worth of their stuff, and they only buy $25 billion worth of our stuff. And the other thing that's been interesting is that, and the Asia-Pacific Foundation plays into this very intimately. John Bruck, who's the founding president of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, the way he described it to me was that the Asia-Pacific Foundation was initially founded to provide Canadians with a window on Asia. And what has happened is the Asia-Pacific Foundation has become subverted to the point where it is a window on Canada that only the Chinese Communist Party makes use of. So the other thing that we have been sold, since we're enumerating bills of goods, is the proposition that the closer that we become to China, the more that we encourage China into the institutions of liberal democracy, like the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the closer we become to China, the more the Chinese will become like us. Now, a couple of things there. It's based on a racist proposition that the Chinese people are not like us somehow, that they're genetically predisposed to tyranny, and they're not. And the other thing that is really astonishing about that is the hubris involved. In fact, what's happened is it's not only been an absolutely failed project, but the opposite has happened. We have become more like the Chinese ruling class. The influence of the Chinese Communist Party in Canada is best, I think, understood in the context of what academic observers have described as elite capture.
Terry Glavin says that the influence of Russians on the Trump campaign in 2016 pales in comparison to the Chinese government influence on political elites in Canada, which has been normalized. Glavin points to the Senate of Canada. Former Canada-China Business Council President Peter Harder headed up Trudeau's 2015 transition team and is now the government leader in the Senate.
And speaking of the Senate, as an institution that has been captured, if you like, by the China trade lobby, the liberal leader in the Senate, Senator Joseph Day, is the head of a notoriously embarrassing Canada-China Legislative Council. In fact, he was in China this past week. You know, here we are, Chrystia Freeland can't even get Wang Yi, her counterpart in Beijing, on the telephone. But there's Senator Joseph Day swanning around with all these Communist Party big shots, being given guided tours of the country. He was there in January, too, just a few weeks after Michael Kodrick and Michael Spavor were abducted and imprisoned China. And he was asked, you know, well, are you going to sort of twist any arms? Are you going to, you know, lather it on a bit? And he said, well, it's not even on the agenda. The largest bloc in the Senate, 105 members of the Senate, 58 members in the Independent Senators Group, it's called. Of course, it's not independent. They're almost all liberal appointees. The leader of that bloc is Yen Pao Wu. Now, you will probably, and maybe some of your listeners will be familiar with Yen Pao Wu, former head of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, head of HQ Vancouver, which was, you know, I think it's totally shut down now, if I'm not mistaken, but had become associated with a number of scandalous, absolutely scandalous, associations with the most dodgy enterprises, from not just Chinese, some of them were just Ponzi schemes out of the United States, but notably, you know, major Chinese multinationals with interests in military hardware and so on being set up operations here in Canada. Yen Pao Wu's maiden speech in the Senate was in defense of the proposition that Canada should mind its tone, keep its head down, and shut up about China's annexation of the South China Sea in defiance of international law. Peter Kent, who's the conservative guy, foreign affairs critic, and Nathan Cullen, the NDP critic in the House, foreign affairs critic, said, both of them said, you know, what have we done? This is like, you know, it would make some sense if Beijing had appointed him leader or senator. So, you know, that's just the Senate of Canada. And there's any number of institutions like that across the country that have been completely mobbed up and thoroughly compromised. It's far later than we think. I'm not a paranoid guy. You know, and I'm certainly not averse to the idea of Chinese immigration. In fact, if we had 10 times the number of Chinese immigrants coming to Canada, I'd be perfectly happy. The difficulty is that we fail to draw distinctions between the, you know, the sort of princeling caste, the red aristocracy, you know, the billionaire parasites that run China, and the ordinary Chinese people. We don't take any refugees from China. We used to. We accept the proposition that money is good, that, you know, you can look at Vancouver real estate and see what the result there has been. Thankfully, we did shut down the immigrant investor program, but that was, what, 100,000 of them? So that's kind of the state of play. And now that we, you know, we merely acted on a fairly routine request from the United States Justice Department to apprehend Meng Wanzhou on an extradition warrant. She's wanted for bank fraud and several counts of evading sanctions in Iran. We're being punished. And Canadians have actually had to sort of confront this. And it's been an extremely awkward situation. Because, you know, we have academic institutions across the country that have completely disgraced themselves and are utterly discredited. And well, so what are they going to say now? I'm sorry, we were wrong for a quarter of a century.
Award-winning journalist and author Terry Glavin. You can read Terry Glavin's work in the National Post and Maclean's.
I, Justin P.J. Trudeau. No! Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways. We're never going to get to unanimity. Not in Canada, not within any community. And there are always voices in favor, and there are people.
You're a weak leader.
Thank you, sir. I've heard you.
I stand here, I honor my ancestors and my children by protecting my lands and waters.
Thank you.
You threaten our lands and waters.
I have heard some fellow leaders of yours.
You have no right to do that to us.
Sir, I have heard from some of your fellow indigenous leaders.
I,
Justin P.J. Trudeau.
No!
Sunny ways, my friends. Sunny ways.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Tony Waiters, part of the class of 2019, inducted last week to the British Columbia Sports Hall of Fame. Waiters came to Vancouver to coach the Vancouver Whitecaps of the North American Soccer League and turned them into the Soccer Bowl 79 champions. Waiters also coached Canada's one and only entry in a FIFA Men's World Cup of Soccer at Mexico 1986. A case can be made that the Englishman is the father of modern soccer in Canada. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting. Custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of May 26th, 2019. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on May 26th in 1967, the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band was released? The Fab Four's eighth studio album was a number one chart topper in the UK and the US. It was inspired by the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds and recorded after the band retired from touring. Now you know. Send me your feedback and send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.